flaming body. The driver's side window abruptly went down, releasing Alan Warner, who dropped to the blacktop, half under the car. The rolls thumped as it passed over him. Sam Cleary, the store owner who looked like Popeye, rushed past Vic, holding a fire extinguisher. Lou Carmody was hollering something, swinging his jacket into Tom Priest, beating at him. It was like he was swatting a stack of burning newspaper. Big black flakes of ash drifted through the air. It was only later that Vic understood those were flakes of charbroiled skin. The toddler in Katie's arms slapped a chubby hand against the storefront window. Hot! Hot, Waddy! Katie seemed to suddenly realize that her child could see everything, and turned on her heel and carried him across the room, away from the window, sobbing as she fled. The rolls trundled another 20 feet before coming to a stop with the bumper against a telephone pole. Flames painted the whole back end, and if there was a child in the trunk, he would have been suffocated or burned to death, but there was no child in the trunk. There was a purse belonging to a woman named Cynthia McCauley, who had disappeared 3 days before from JFK Airport, along with her son Brad, but neither Brad nor Cynthia was ever seen again. No one could explain the thumping noise that had seemed to come from the rear of the car, like the window rolling up with a door flying open and smashing into Tom Priest. It seemed almost that the car had acted with a mind of its own. Sam Cleary reached the two old men fighting on the ground and used the fire extinguisher for the first time, bringing it down two-handed to hit Charlie Manx in the face. He would use it for the second time on Tom Priest, not 30 seconds later, by which time Tom was well dead. Not to mention well done. Interlude, The Spirit of Ecstasy, 2000 to 2012. Gun Barrel, Colorado. The first time Vic McQueen took a long-distance call from Christmasland, she was an unwed mother, living with her boyfriend in a double-wide, and it was snowing in Colorado. She had lived in New England her whole life, and she thought she knew about snow, but it was different in the Rockies. The storms were different. She thought of the blizzards in the Rockies as blue weather. The snow came down fast and hard and steady, and there was something blue about the light. So it was as if she were trapped in a secret world under a glacier, a winter place where it was eternally Christmas Eve. Vic would walk outside in her moccasins and one of Lou's enormous T-shirts, which she could wear like nightgowns, to stand in the blue dimness and listen to the snow fall. It hissed in the branches of the pines like static, like white noise. She would stand there breathing in the sweet smell of wood smoke and pines, trying to figure out how in the hell she had wound up with sore tits and no job, 2,000 miles from home. The best she could work out, she was there on a mission of vengeance. She had returned to Colorado after graduating from Haverhill High to attend art school. She wanted to go to art school because her mother was dead set against it, and her father refused to pay for it. Other choices her mother couldn't bear and her father didn't want to know about? Vic smoking pot, skipping class to go skiing, making out with girls, shacking up with the fat delinquent who had rescued her from Charlie Manx, getting pregnant without bothering to get married. Linda had always said she wouldn't have anything to do with the baby born out of wedlock, so Vic had not invited her after the birth, and when Linda offered to come, Vic said she'd rather that she didn't. She had not even bothered to send her father a picture of the baby. She still remembered how good it felt to look into Lou Carmody's face, over coffees in a yuppie cafe in Boulder, and to say, bluntly and pleasantly, "So I guess I should fuck you for saving my life, huh? Least I can do. Do you want to finish your coffee, or should we just split now?" After their first time, Lou admitted he had never slept with a girl before, his face glowing dark red, from both his exertions and his embarrassment. Still a virgin in his early 20s, who said there was no wonder left in the world? Sometimes she resented Louis for not being satisfied with sex alone. He had to love her, too. He wanted talk as much as he wanted sex, maybe more. He wanted to do things for her, buy her things, get tattoos together, go on trips. Sometimes she resented herself for letting him corner her into being his friend. It seemed to her she had planned to be stronger, to simply fuck him a time or two, to show him she was a girl who knew how to appreciate a guy, then drop him and get herself an alternative girlfriend, someone with a pink streak in her hair and a few beads in her tongue. The problem with that plan was, she liked guys better than girls, and she liked Lou better than most guys. He smelled good, and he moved slow, and he was roughly as difficult to anger as a character from the Hundred Acre Wood. Soft as a character from the Hundred Acre Wood, too. It irritated her that she liked to touch him and lean against him. Her body was constantly working against her, toward its own unhelpful ends. Lou worked out of a garage he had opened with some cash given to him by his parents, and they lived in the trailer in back, 2 miles outside of Gun Barrel, 1,000 miles from anything. Vic didn't have a car and probably spent 160 hours a week at home. The house smelled of piss-soaked diapers and engine parts, and the sink was always full. In retrospect, Vic was only surprised she didn't go crazy sooner. She was surprised that more young mothers didn't lose it. When your tits had become canteens and the soundtrack of your life was hysterical tears and mad laughter, how could anyone expect you to remain sane? She had a single occasional escape hatch. Whenever it snowed, she left Wayne with Lou, borrowed the tow truck, and said she was going into town for an espresso and a magazine. It was something to tell them. Vic didn't want to let them in on the truth. What she was actually going to do felt like a curiously private, possibly even shameful, personal matter. So it happened one day, all of them trapped inside together. Wayne was banging on a toy xylophone with a spoon, Lou was burning pancakes, the TV was blaring Dora the fucking Explorer. Vic let herself into the yard for a smoke. It was blue outside, and the snow fell hissing in the trees. And by the time she had smoked her American Spirit down far enough to burn her fingers, she knew she needed a ride in the tow. She borrowed the keys from Lou, put on the Colorado Avalanche hoodie, and crossed to the garage, locked up on that frozen blue Sunday morning. Inside, it smelled of metal and spilled oil, an odor very like blood. Wayne had that smell on him all the time, and she hated it. The boy, Bruce Wayne Carmody, Bruce to his paternal grandparents, Wayne to Vic, and the Bat to Lou, spent most of the day cooing to himself in the safe enclosure of a tire meant for a monster truck. It was what they had instead of a playpen. Her baby's father was a man who owned only 2 pairs of underwear and had a tattoo of the Joker on his hip. It was something, going over all the things that had led her to this place of high rock, endless snows, and hopelessness. She could not quite work out how she had found her way here. She used to be so good at finding the place she wanted to go. In the garage, she paused, 1 foot on the running board of the truck. Lou had picked up a job painting a motorcycle for a pal. He had just finished putting a coat of dull black primer on the gas tank. The gas tank looked like a weapon now, like a bomb. On the floor beside the bike was a sheet of transfer paper with a flaming skull on it and the words "Hardcore" written below. Vic took one glance at what Lou had painted on the transfer paper and knew he was going to fuck up the job. And it was a curious thing. Something about the crudity of his illustration, its obvious failings, made her feel almost ill with love for him. Ill and guilty. Even then, some part of her already knew she was going to leave him someday. Even then, some part of her felt that Lou and Wayne both, deserved better than Vic McQueen. The highway switched back for 2 miles down to Gun Barrel, where there were coffee houses, candle shops, and a spa that did cream cheese facials. But Vic got less than halfway there before turning off the highway onto a dirt side road that dropped through the pines into deep lumber country. She flicked on the headlights and buried the gas pedal. It felt like plunging off a cliff. It felt like suicide. The big Ford crashed through brush, banged through ruts, tipped over ledges. She drove at unsafe speed, slewing around corners and throwing snow and rocks. She was looking for something. Vic stared intently into the headlights, which cut a hole in the falling snow, a white passageway. The snow flurried past, as if she were driving through a tunnel of static. Vic felt that it was close, the shorter way bridge, waiting just beyond the farthest reach of the headlights. She felt it was a matter of speed. If she could just go fast enough, she could force it back into existence, leap off the rutted logging road and onto the old boards of the bridge. But she never dared push the truck beyond the speed at which she could control it, and she never reached the shorter way. Maybe if she had her bike back. Maybe if it were summer. Maybe if she were not stupid enough to have had a baby, She hated that she'd have the baby. Now she was fucked. She loved Wayne too much to press the pedal to the floor and go flying into the darkness. She thought love had something to do with happiness, but it turned out they were not even vaguely related. Love was closer to a need, no different from the need to eat, to breathe. When Wayne fell asleep, his hot cheek against her naked breast, his lips smelling sweetly of the milk from her own body, she felt as if she was the one who had been fed. Maybe she could not bring forth the bridge because there was nothing left to find. Maybe she had found everything the world had to offer her, a notion very like despair. It was no good being a mother. She wanted to start a website, a public awareness campaign, a newsletter, to get the word out that if you were a woman and you had a child, you lost everything. You would be held hostage by love. A terrorist who would only be satisfied when you surrendered your entire future. The lumber road dead-ended at a gravel pit, which was where she turned back. As was often the case, she drove back toward the highway with a headache. No, not a headache. It wasn't a pain in her head. It was a pain in her left eye. A slow, soft throb. She drove back to the garage, singing along to Kurt Cobain. Kurt Cobain understood what it tasted like to lose your magic bridge, the transport to the things you needed. It tasted like a gun barrel. Like Gun Barrel, Colorado, perhaps. She parked in the garage and sat behind the wheel in the cold, watching her breath smoke. She might have sat there forever if the phone hadn't rung. It was on the wall, right outside the door to the office Lou never used. It was old enough to have a rotary dial, like the phone in Charlie Manx's sleigh house. Its ring was harsh and brassy. Vic frowned. The phone was on a separate line from the one in the house. It was comically referred to as the business line. No one ever called them on it. She dropped from the front seat a good 4 feet to the concrete floor. She caught the phone on the third ring. "Carmody's car, Karma," she said. The phone was painfully cold. Her palm, clutching the receiver, made a pale frost halo on the plastic. There was a hiss, as if the call were coming from a great distance. In the background, Vic heard carolers, the sounds of sweet children's voices. It was a little early for that, mid-November. A boy said, "Hello, can I help you?"
Yes, the boy said. "I'm Brad. Brad McCauley. I'm calling from Christmasland."
She recognized the boy's name, but at first she couldn't place it. "Brad," she said, "can I help you? Where did you say you're calling from?"
"From Christmasland, silly. You know who I am. I was in the car," he said. "At Mr. Manx's house. You remember, we had fun."
Her chest was icy. It was hard to breathe. "Oh, fuck you, kid," she said. "Fuck you and your sick motherfucking joke."
"The reason I'm calling," he said, "we're all getting hungry. There hasn't been anything to eat forever. And what's the point of having all these teeth if you can't use them on something?"
"Call back and I'll put the cops on you, you deranged fuck," she said, and banged the phone down in the cradle. Vic put a hand over her mouth and made a sound, somewhere between a sob and a cry of rage. She bent double and shook in the freezing garage. When she had recovered herself, she straightened, lifted the phone, and calmly called the operator. "Can you give me the number that just rang this line?" Vic asked. "We were cut off. I want to be reconnected."
"The line you're on?"
"Yes, I was cut off just a moment ago."
"I'm sorry. I have a phone call from Friday afternoon for an 800 number. Do you want me to connect you?"
"A call came in just a moment ago. I want to know who it was." There was a silence before the operator replied, a caesura in which Vic could make out the sounds of other operator voices speaking in the background.
"I'm sorry. I don't have any calls to this line since Friday."
"Thank you," Vic said and hung up. She was sitting on the floor beneath the phone, with her arms wrapped around her, when Lou found her.
"You've been, like, sitting out here for a while," he said. "Do you want me to bring you a blanket or a dead tauntaun or something?"
"What's a tauntaun?"
"Something like a camel, or maybe a big goat. I don't think it matters."
"What's Wayne doing?"
"He snoozed off. He's cool. What are you doing out here?"
He looked around the dimness as if he thought there was a chance she might not be alone.
She needed to tell him something, make up some explanation for why she was sitting on the floor in a cold, dark garage, so she nodded at the motorcycle he had primed. Thinking about the bike you're working on. He considered her through narrowed eyes. She could tell he didn't believe her. But then he looked at the motorcycle and the transfer paper on the floor beside it and said, I'm worried I'm gonna fuck it up. You think it'll come out okay? Nope, I don't. Sorry. He shot her a startled look. For real? She smiled weakly and nodded. He heaved a great sigh. Can you tell me what I did wrong? Hardcore is one word, not two. And your E looks like the number 8. But also, you have to write in reverse. When you stick the transfer paper on and make the copy, hardcore is going to be backward. Oh, shit. Dude, I'm such an idiot. Lou cast her another hopeful glance. At least you liked my skull, right? Honestly? Lou stared at his feet. Christ, I was hoping Tony B would throw me $50 or something for doing a good paint job. If you didn't stop me, I'd probably have to pay him $50 for ruining his bike. Why am I not good at anything? You're a good dad. It ain't rocket science. Novik thought it was harder. Do you want me to fix it? She asked. You ever painted a bike before? No. He nodded. Well, okay. If you fuck it up, we'll just say I did it. No one will be surprised. But if you kick its ass, we should tell people who really painted it. Might pull in some more jobs. He gave her another long look, sizing her up. You sure you're all right? You aren't out here pondering dark female thoughts, are you? No. You ever think, like, you shouldn't have quit on therapy? You've been through some shit, dude. Maybe you ought to talk about it. About him. I just did, she thought. I had a nice little chat with the last kid Charlie Manx kidnapped. He's some kind of cold vampire now, and he's in Christmasland, and he wants something to eat. I think the talking is done, she said, and took Lou's hand when he offered it. Maybe I'll just paint instead. Sugar Creek, Pennsylvania. Early in the summer of 2001, the news reached Bing Partridge that Charlie Manx was bad sick. Bing was 53 by then and had not put his gas mask on in 5 years. Bing found out from an article on AOL, which he accessed using the big black Dell computer he had received from NorChem Farm for 30 years of service. He looked at AOL every day for news out of Colorado about Mr. Manx, but there had been nothing for ages until this. Charles Talent Manx III, age unknown, convicted murderer, suspect in dozens of child abductions, had been moved to the hospital wing of FCI Englewood when it proved impossible to wake him up. Manx was examined by prominent Denver neurosurgeon Mark Sofer, who described his condition as one for the medical books. The patient appears to suffer from adult progeria, or a rare form of Werner syndrome, Sofer said. In the simplest terms, he has begun to age very rapidly. A month is more like a year for him. A year is close to a decade. And this guy was no spring chicken to begin with. The doctor said there was no way to tell if Manx's condition could partially explain the aberrant behavior that led to his brutal slaying of PFC Thomas Priest in 1995. He also declined to describe Charlie Manx's current state as a coma. He doesn't meet the strict definition of coma. His brain function is high, as if he's dreaming. He just can't wake up anymore. His body is too tired. He doesn't have any gas left in the tank. Bing had often thought of writing Mr. Manx to tell him he was still faithful, still loved him, would always love him, would be there to serve him until the day he died. But while Bing was maybe not the shiniest bulb on the Christmas tree, ha ha, he was smart enough to know that Mr. Manx would be furious with him for writing, and correct to be. A letter from Bing would for sure lead to men in suits knocking on the door, men in sunglasses with guns and armpit holsters.
Hello, Mr. Partridge. Would you mind answering a few questions? How would you feel about us planting a shovel in your basement, digging around for a bit?
So he had never written. And now it was too late, and the thought made him feel sick. Mr. Manx had passed a message to Bing once, although by what means Bing didn't know. A package had been dropped on the doorstep with no return address on it, 2 days after Mr. Manx was sentenced to life in Englewood. Inside were a pair of license plates, NOS 482, Kansas, and a little card on ivory-laid stock with a Christmas angel stamped into the front.
"Hold these. I might be a while. 9.
Bing had the license plates in the root cellar, where all the rest of his life with Charlie Manx was buried. The empty stolen tanks of Savora Flame, his daddy's 45, and the remains of the women, the mothers that Bing had brought home with him after many a mission of salvation with Mr. Manx. 9 missions in all. Brad McCauley had been the 9th child they had saved for Christmasland, and his mother, Cynthia, the last whore Bing had dealt with in the quiet room downstairs. In a way, she had been saved as well, before she died. Bing had taught her about love. Bing and Mr. Manx had planned to save one more child in the summer of 1997, and that time Bing would go all the way to Christmasland with Mr. Manx, to live where no one grew old and unhappiness was against the law, where he could ride all the rides and drink all the cocoa and open Christmas gifts every morning. When he thought about the cosmic unfairness of it, of Mr. Manx being ripped away right before he could swing wide the gates of Christmasland to Bing at last, he felt smashed inside, as if hope were a vase that had been dropped from a height. Crunch! The worst of it, though, was not losing Mr. Manx or losing Christmasland. It was losing love. It was losing the mommies. His last, Mrs. McCauley, had been the best. They had long talks in the basement together. Mrs. McCauley, naked and tanned and fit, clasped against Bing's side. She was 40, but stringy with muscle that she had built up coaching girls' volleyball. Her skin radiated heat and health. She stroked the graying hair on Bing's chest and told him she loved him better than her mother or father. Better than Jesus. Better than her own son. Better than kittens. Better than sunshine. It felt good to hear her say it. "I love you, Bing Partridge. I love you so much it's burning me. I'm all kindling inside. It's burning me alive." Her breath had been sweet with the smell of the gingerbread smoke. She was so fit and so healthy. He had to dose her with his flavored sevoflurane mix once every 3 hours. She loved him so much she cut her own wrists when he told her they couldn't live together. They made love one last time while she bled out, while she bled all over him.
"Does it hurt?" he asked.
"Oh, Bing, Bing, you silly thing," she said. "I've been burning with love for days. A couple little cuts like these, they don't hurt at all." She was so pretty, had such perfect mommy tits. He couldn't bear to pour the lye on her until she began to smell. Even with flies in her hair, she was pretty. Extra pretty, really. The blue bottles glittered like gems. Bing had visited the graveyard of what might be with Mr. Manx, and knew that if Cynthia McCauley had been left to her own devices, she would have killed her son in a steroid-fueled rage. But down in his quiet room, Bing had taught her kindness and love and how to suck cock. So at least she ended her life on a good note. That was what it was all about, taking something awful and making something good of it. Mr. Manx saved the children, and Bing saved the mommies. Now, though, the mommies were over and done. Mr. Manx was locked up gone, and Bing's gas mask hung on a hook behind the back door, where it had been since 1996. He read the story in the news about Mr. Manx falling asleep, into a deep, endless sleep, a brave soldier under a wicked enchantment, and then printed it and folded it and decided to pray on it some. In his 53rd year, Bing Partridge had become a church-going man once again, had returned to the New American Faith Tabernacle in the hopes that God would offer some comfort for one of his loneliest children. Bing prayed that one day he would hear White Christmas playing in the driveway and would push back the linen curtain and see Mr. Manx behind the wheel of the wraith, the window rolled down and the good man gazing out at him.
"Come on, Bing. Let's go for a ride. Number 10 is waiting for us. Let's go grab one more kid and take you to Christmas Land. Heaven knows you've earned it.
He climbed the steep hill in the smothering heat of a July afternoon. The foil flowers in his front yard, 29 of them, were perfectly still and silent. He hated them. He hated the blue sky, too, and the maddening harmonic of the cicadas throbbing in the trees. Bing trudged up the hill with the news story in one hand. Rare condition befalls convicted murderer. And Mr. Max's final note in the other. I might be a while. 9. To speak to God about these things. The church stood in a hectare of buckled blacktop, shoots of pale grass as high as Bing's knees sticking up through the cracks. A loop of heavy-duty chain and a Yale lock held the front door shut. No one except for Bing himself had prayed there for going on 15 years. The tabernacle had belonged to the Lord once, but now it was property of the moneylenders. A sun-faded sheet of paper in a clear plastic envelope tacked to one of the doors said so. The cicadas buzzed in Bing's head, like madness. Out at one end of the lot was a big sign like they'd have out in front of a Dairy Queen or a used car lot, telling people which hymn they'd be singing that day. Only in God, and He's alive again, and the Lord never sleeps. Devotions were promised for 1 p.m. The sign had been promising those same hymns since Reagan's second term. Some of the stained glass windows had holes where kids had chucked rocks at them, but Bing didn't climb in that way. There was a shed out to one side of the church, half hidden back in the dusty poplars and sumac. A rotting cord doormat lay in front of the shed's door. A bright brass key was hidden beneath it. The key opened the padlock on the sloped cellar doors at the back of the building. Bing let himself below. He crossed a cool subterranean room, wading through the smell of old creosote and mildewed books, and came up into the big open theater of the church. Bing had always liked church, back in the days when he still went with his mother. He had liked the way the sun came through the 20-foot-high stained glass windows, filling the room with warmth and color, and he had liked the way the mommies dressed, in white lace and heels and milky white stockings. Bing loved white stockings and loved to hear a woman sing. All the mommies who stayed with him in the house of sleep sang before they took their last rest. But after the pastor ran away with the whole treasury and the bank locked the church up, Bing found that the place troubled him. He did not like the way the shadow of the steeple seemed to reach for his house in the late of day. Bing found after he started taking mommies back to his home, a place Mr. Manx had christened the House of Sleep, he could hardly stand to look at the top of the hill anymore. The church loomed, the shadow of the steeple an accusing finger that stretched down the slope and pointed at his front yard. Here is a deadly killer, 9 dead women in his basement. Bing tried to tell himself he was being foolish. He and Mr. Max were heroes, really. They did Christian work. If someone wrote a book about them, you would have to mark them down as the good guys. It did not matter that many of the mothers, when dosed with sevoflurane, would still not admit to their plans to whore their daughters or beat their sons, and that several contended they had never taken drugs, did not drink to excess, and did not have criminal records. Those things were in the future, a wretched future that Bing and Mr. Manx worked hard to prevent. If he was ever arrested, because of course no lawman would ever understand the importance and basic goodness of their vocation, Bing felt he could talk about his work with pride. There was no shame in him about any of the things he had done with Mr. Manx. Still, he occasionally had trouble looking up at the church. He told himself, as he climbed the steps from the basement, that he was being a ninny, that all men were welcome in God's house, and Mr. Manx needed Bing's prayers, now more than ever. For himself, Bing had never felt so alone or forlorn. A few weeks earlier, Mr. Paladin had asked Bing what he was going to do with himself after he retired. Bing was shocked and asked why he would retire. He liked his job. Mr. Paladin blinked and said after 30 years they would make him retire. You didn't get a choice in the matter. Bing had never thought about it. He had assumed that by now he would be drinking cocoa in Christmas Land, opening presents in the morning, singing carols in the night.
The vast, empty sanctuary did not put his mind at ease that afternoon. Just the opposite, in fact. All the pews were still there, although they were no longer lined up in neat rows but had been shoved this way and that, were as crooked as Mr. Manx's teeth. The floor was littered with broken glass and chunks of plaster, which crunched underfoot. The room smelled rankly of ammonia, of bird piss. Someone had been in here drinking. The bottles and beer cans left behind littered the pews. He went on, pacing the length of the room. His passage disturbed the swallows in the rafters. The sound of their beating wings echoed, a noise like a magician spraying playing cards into the air. The light that slanted in through the windows was cold and blue, and motes of dust turned within the bars of sunshine, as if the church were the interior of a snow globe just beginning to settle. Someone, teenagers, homeless, had made an altar in one of the deep-set window frames. Deformed red candles stood in hardened puddles of wax, and set behind the candles were several photographs of Michael Stipe from REM, a scrawny queer with pale hair and pale eyes. Someone had written, "Losing My Religion," on one of the photographs in cherry lipstick. Bing himself felt there had not been a single thing worth listening to in rock music since Abbey Road. Bing set the card from Mr. Manx and the printout from the Denver Post in the center of this homemade altar and lit a couple candles for the good man. He cleared some space on the floor, kicking aside chunks of broken plaster and a dirty pair of panties, little hearts on them, looked like they'd fit a 10-year-old, and got on his knees. He cleared his throat. In the vast echoing space of the church, it sounded as loud as a gunshot. A swallow rattled its wings, gliding from one rafter to another. He could see a line of pigeons leaning forward to stare down at him with their bright rabies-red eyes. They watched him with fascination. He shut his eyes and put his hands together and spoke with God. "Hey there, God," Bing said. "It's Bing, that old dumb thing. Oh, God, 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 please help Mr. Manx. Mr. Manx has the sleepies bad, and I don't know what to do. And if he doesn't get better and come back to me, I'll never have my trip to Christmas Land. I tried my best to do something good with my life. I tried my best to save children and make sure they'd have cocoa and rides and things. It wasn't easy. No one wanted us to save them. But even when the mommies screamed and called us awful names, even when their children cried and wet themselves, I loved them. I loved those kids, and I loved their mommies, even if they were bad women. And I loved Mr. Manx most of all. Everything he does so other people can be happy. Isn't that the kindest thing a person can do? Spread a little happiness around? Please, God, if we did any good at all, please, help me. Give me a sign. Tell me what to do. Please, 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 pull." His face was tipped back and his mouth was open when something hot hit his cheek, and he tasted something salty and bitter on his lips. He flinched. It was like someone had come on him. He swiped at his mouth and looked at his fingers, now coated with a whitish-green crud, a sloppy liquid mash. It took a moment to identify it as pigeon shit. Bing groaned, once, then again. His mouth was full of the salt creme taste of bird shit. The stuff cupped in his palm looked like diseased phlegm. His moaning rose to a scream, and he pitched himself backward, kicking plaster and glass, and put his other hand down on something damp and sticky with the soft texture of saran wrap. He glanced down and discovered he had planted his hand on a soiled condom crawling with ants. He lifted his hand in horror, in revulsion, and the condom stuck to his fingers, and he flicked his hand once, twice, and it flipped up and landed in his hair. He shrieked. Birds exploded from the rafters. "What?" he screamed to the church. "What? I came here on my knees. I came on my knees. And you do what? What?" He grabbed the rubber and yanked, tearing out a fistful of his own wispy gray hair at the same time. When had it all turned gray? Dust swirled in the light. Bing Partridge went down the hill in a shambling jog, feeling defiled, ill, and outraged. He reeled like a drunk past the foil flowers in his front yard and banged the door shut behind him. It was the gas mask man who stepped out 20 minutes later, a bottle of lighter fluid in each hand. Before he lit the place up, he boarded over the holes in the windows so the birds couldn't get out. He drizzled most of one bottle over the pews and the heaps of broken wood and plaster on the floor. Perfect little pre-made bonfires. The other bottle he emptied on the figure of Jesus, mounted on his cross up in the apse. He looked cold in his little loincloth, so Bing flicked a match and dressed him in a robe of flame. Mary gazed sadly down at this latest indignity inflicted upon her son from a mural above him. Bing tapped 2 fingers to the mouthpiece of his mask, blew her a kiss. Give him a chance to grab child number 10 with Mr. Manx, Bing thought, and he didn't care if he had to gas and kill Christ's own mama to get the little bastard. Besides, there wasn't anything the Holy Ghost had done in Mother Mary's pussy that Bing couldn't have done better if he had 3 days alone with her in the House of Sleep. Gun Barrel, Colorado. The children never called when she was painting. It was months before Vic understood this consciously, but on some level of her mind that existed beneath reason, she got it almost right away. When she wasn't painting, when she didn't have creative work to occupy her, she became aware of a growing physical apprehension, like she was standing beneath a crane that was holding a piano aloft. At any moment she felt that the cables could snap and all that weight could fall upon her with a fatal crash. So she lined up every job she could get and spent 70 hours a week in the garage listening to Foreigner and airbrushing motorcycles for men with criminal records and offensive racial notions. Vic painted flames and guns and naked chicks and grenades and Dixie flags and Nazi flags and Jesus Christ and white tigers and rotting ghouls and more naked chicks. She didn't think of herself as an artist. Painting kept Christmasland from calling and paid for Pampers. All other considerations were of little importance. Sometimes, though, the jobs dried up. Sometimes it seemed she had painted every motorcycle in the Rockies, and there would never be another gig. When that happened, when she had more than a week or two without painting, she found herself grimly waiting, readying herself. Then one day the phone would ring. It happened in September, on a Tuesday morning, 5 years after Manx went to jail. Lou had gone out before the sun came up to tow someone out of a ditch, left her with Wayne, who wanted hot dogs for breakfast. All those years smelled of steaming hot dogs and steaming baby shit. Wayne was parked in front of the tube, and Vic was squirting ketchup into cheap hot dog rolls when the phone rang. She stared at the receiver. It was too early for the phone to be ringing, and she already knew who it was, because she had not painted anything in almost a month. Vic touched the receiver. It was cold. Wayne, she said. The boy looked up, finger in his mouth, drool down the front of his X-Men t-shirt. Do you hear the phone ringing, Wayne? She asked. He stared at her blankly, uncomprehendingly for a moment, then shook his head. It rang again. There, she said. There. Did you hear it? Don't you hear it ringing?
No.
He said, and wagged his head heavily from side to side. He turned his attention back to the television. Vic picked up the receiver. A child, not Brad McCauley, a different child, a girl this time, said,
"When is Daddy coming back to Christmasland? What did you do with Daddy?"
"You aren't real," Vic said. In the background, she could hear the children caroling.
"Yes, I am,"
the girl said. A white breath of frozen air seethed through the small holes in the earpiece of the receiver.
"We're just as real as what's happening in New York this morning. You should see what's happening in New York. It's exciting. People are jumping into the sky. It's exciting and it's fun. It's almost as fun as Christmasland."
"You aren't real," Vic whispered again.
"You told lies about Daddy," she said. That was bad. You're a bad mother. Wayne should be with us. He could play with us all day. We could teach him how to play scissors for the drifter.
Vic slammed the phone into the cradle. She picked it up and slammed it down once more. Wayne glanced around at her, his eyes wide and alarmed. She waved a hand at him, never mind, and turned away, struggling not to cry, breath hitching. The hot dogs boiled over, water jumping out of the pot and spattering into the blue flame of the gas burner. She ignored them, sank down onto the kitchen floor, and covered her eyes. It was an act of will to contain her sobs. She didn't want to scare Wayne.
"Em,"
her boy called, and she looked up, blinking.
"Something happened to Oscar."
Oscar was his word for Sesame Street.
"Something happened, and Oscar went bye-bye."
Vic wiped at her streaming eyes, took a shuddering breath, turned off the gas. She walked unsteadily to the television. Sesame Street had gone to a news break. A big jet had hit one of the World Trade Towers in New York City. Black smoke churned into blue, blue sky. A few weeks later, Vic made space in the closet-sized second bedroom, tidied and swept. She moved an easel in there and mounted Bristol board on it.
"What you doing?"
Lou asked, pushing his head through the door the day after she set herself up.
"Thought I'd draw a picture book," Vic said.
She had the first page sketched in blue pencil, was almost ready to start inking. Lou peered over her shoulder.
"Are you drawing a motorcycle factory?"
he asked.
"Close. A robot factory," she said.
"The hero is a robot named Search Engine. On each page, he has to work his way through a maze and find some items of importance. Power cells and secret plans and stuff."
"I think I'm popping a boner for your picture book. Awesome thing to do for Wayne. He's gonna shit."
Vic nodded. She was happy to let Lou think she was doing it for the kid. She had no illusions, though. She was doing it for herself. The picture book was better than painting Harleys. It was steady work, and it was there every day. After she started drawing Search Engine, the phone never rang unless a credit agency was calling. After she sold the book, the credit agencies quit calling, too. Brandenburg, Kentucky. Michelle Demeter was 12 the first time her father let her drive it. A 12-year-old girl driving a 1938 Rolls-Royce Wraith through the high grass in the first days of summer, with the windows rolled down and Christmas music playing on the radio. Michelle sang along in a big, happy, braying voice, off-key and off-time. When she did not know the lyrics, she made them up. "Come, all ye faithful, jiggy and triumphant, come, all ye faithful, sing yea for the Lord." The car swam through the grass, a black shark slicing through a rippling ocean of yellows and greens. Birds scattered before it, darting into a lemon sky. The wheels banged and thudded in unseen ruts. Her father, crocked and getting crockter, sat in the passenger seat fiddling with the tuner, a warm Coors between his legs. Only the tuner didn't do anything. The radio jumped from band to band, but everything was white noise. The only station they came in at all was distant, crackling, and awash with background hiss and playing that goddamn holiday music. "Who is playing this shit in the middle of May?" he asked, and burped, enormously and grotesquely. Michelle giggled in appreciation. There was no way to turn the radio off or even down. The volume dial spun uselessly, adjusting nothing. "This car is like your old man," Nathan said, pulling another Coors out of the six-pack at his feet, popping another top. "A wreck of its former self." That was just more of his silly talk. Her father wasn't doing so bad. He had invented some kind of valve for Boeing, and it had paid for 300 acres above the Ohio River. They were driving around it now. The car, on the other hand, really had left its best days behind it. The carpet was gone, and where it belonged was bare, humming metal. There were holes under the pedals, and through them Michelle could see grass whipping by below. The leather on the dash was peeling.
One of the back doors didn't match the others, was unpainted and caked with rust. There was no rear window at all, just a round, open hole. No back seat either, and a char mark in the rear compartment, where it looked as if someone had tried to light a campfire once. The girl worked the clutch and the gas and the brake expertly with her right foot, just as her father had taught her. The front seat was cranked all the way forward, and still she had to sit on a pillow so she could see over the high dash and out the window. One of these days I'm going to get around to working on this beast. Roll my sleeves up and bring the old lady all the way back to life. Be a hell of a thing to have it completely restored so you could take it to the prom, her father said. When you're old enough for proms. Yeah, good call. Plenty of room in the back seat to make out, she said, twisting her neck to look over her shoulder into the rear. It'd also be a nice ride to take you to the nunnery inn. You keep your eyes on the road, why don't you? Gesturing with his beer can at the rise and fall of the land and the tangles of grass and brush and goldenrod. No road in sight in any direction. The only sign of human existence, the distant bar in the rearview mirror, and the jet contrails overhead. She pumped the pedals. They wheezed and gasped. The only thing Michelle didn't like about the car was the hood ornament, a creepy silver lady with blind eyes and a flowing gown. She leaned out into the lashing weeds and grinned manically as she was flagellated. That silver lady should have been magical and pretty, but the smile on her face ruined it. She had the demented grin of a madwoman who has just pushed a loved one off a ledge and is about to follow him into eternity. She's awful, Michelle said, lifting her chin in the direction of the hood. Like a vampire lady. The bloofer lady, her father said, remembering something he had read once. The who? She is not called the bloofer lady. No, Nathan said. She's called the spirit of ecstasy. She's classic. She's a classic part of a classic car. Ecstasy? Like the drug? Michelle asked. Wow, trippy. They were into that back then? No, not like the drug. Like fun. She's a symbol of never-ending fun. I think she's pretty, he said, although in fact he thought she looked like one of the Joker's victims, a rich lady who had died laughing. I've been driving out to Christmas land all the livelong day, Michelle sang softly. For the moment, the radio was just a roar of static and whine, and she could sing without competition. I've been driving out to Christmas land, just to ride in Santa's sleigh. What's that one? I don't know it, her dad said. That's where we're going, she said. To Christmas land. I just decided. The sky was trying on a variety of citrus hues. Michelle felt perfectly at peace. She felt she could drive forever. Her tone was soft with excitement and delight. And when her father glanced at her, there was a dew of sweat on her forehead, and her eyes had a faraway look. It's out there, Daddy, she said. It's out there in the mountains. If we kept going, we could be in Christmasland by tonight. Nathan Demeter narrowed his eyes and peered out through the dusty window. A vast, pale mountain range towered in the west, with snow-touched peaks higher than the Rockies. A mountain range that had not been there this morning, or even when they set out on this drive, 20 minutes ago. He looked quickly away, blinking to clear his vision, then looked back. And the mountain range resolved into a looming mass of thunderheads, crowding the western horizon. His heart continued to run a three-legged race in his chest for a few moments longer. Too bad you have homework. No Christmas land for you, he said. Even though it was Saturday and no dad anywhere made his 12-year-old do algebra on a Saturday. Time to turn us around, sweetheart. Daddy has things to do. He slouched back in his seat and had a sip of beer, but he didn't want it anymore. He felt the first dull edge of tomorrow's hangover in his left temple. Judy Garland was tragically wishing everyone a merry little Christmas, and what the fuck was the DJ smoking playing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas in May? But the music only lasted until they reached the weedy edge of their property, and Michelle laboriously turned the wraith around to point them back toward home. As the rolls wheeled in a semicircle, the radio lost what little reception it had, and once more became a low roar of white noise, of mad static. It was 2006, and Nathan Demeter had himself an old junker to fix up. Bought in a federal auction, something to play with in his spare time. One of these days he was going to get around to really working on it. One of these days he was going to make the old lady shine. New York and everywhere else. Here is what they said about the second search engine book in the New York Times Book Review. Children's Book Section, Sunday, July 8th, 2007. The only time any of Vic McQueen's books were reviewed there. Search Engine Second Gear by Vic McQueen. 22 pages. HarperCollins Children's Books. $16.95. Puzzle Picture Book, ages 6 to 12. If M.C. Escher were hired to reimagine Where's Waldo, it might look something like Miss McQueen's fascinating and deservedly popular Search Engine series. The eponymous hero, Search Engine, a cheerful and childlike robot who resembles a cross between C-3PO and a Harley Davidson, pursues Mad Mobius Strip across a series of dizzying, impossible constructions and surreal mazes. One confounding puzzle cannot be solved without placing a mirror against the edge of the book. Another mind-bender requires the children to roll the page up into a tube to make a magical covered bridge. A third must be torn out and folded into an origami motorcycle, so Search Engine can continue his pursuit at full throttle. Young readers who complete Search Engine's second gear will find themselves faced with the most terrible puzzle of them all. How long until the next one? FCI Englewood, Colorado. Nurse Thornton dropped into the long-term care ward a little before 8 with a hot bag of blood for Charlie Max. Denver, Colorado. The first Saturday in October 2009, Lou told Victoria McQueen he was taking the kid and going to his mother's for a while. For some reason, he told her this in a whisper, with the door shut, so Wayne, out in the living room, couldn't hear them talking. Lou's round face shone with nervous sweat. He licked his lips a lot while he spoke. They were in the bedroom together. Lou sat on the edge of the bed, causing the mattress to creak and sag halfway to the floor. It was hard for Vic to get comfortable in the bedroom. She kept looking at the phone on the night table, waiting for it to ring. She had tried to get rid of it a few days ago, had unplugged it and shoved it into a bottom drawer, but at some point Lou had discovered it there and plugged it back in. Lou said some other stuff, about how worried he was, about how everyone was worried. She didn't catch all of it. Her whole mind was bent toward the phone, watching it, waiting for it to ring. She knew it would. Waiting for it was awful. It angered her that Lou had brought her inside, that they couldn't have this conversation out on the deck. It shook her faith in him. It was impossible to have a conversation in a room with a phone. It was like having a conversation in a room with a bat hanging from the ceiling. Even if the bat was asleep, how were you supposed to think about anything else or look at anything else? If the phone rang, she would yank it out of the wall and get it out to the deck and throw it over the side. She was tempted not to wait, to just do it now. She was surprised when Lou said maybe she should go see her mother, too. Vic's mother was all the way hell and gone back in Massachusetts, and Lou knew they didn't get on. The only thing that would have been more ridiculous was suggesting that Vic go see her father, whom she had not spoken to in years. I'd rather go to jail than stay with my mom. Jesus, Lou. Do you know how many phones my mother has in her house? Vic asked. Lou gave her a look that was somehow both distraught and weary. It was a look, Vic thought, of surrender. If you want to talk, like, about anything, I've got my cell on me, Lou said. Vic just laughed at that, didn't bother to tell him she had pulled his cell phone apart and shoved it in the garbage the day before. He took her in his arms, held her in his bearish embrace. He was a big man, glum about being overweight, but he smelled better than any guy she had ever met. His chest smelled of cedar and motor oil and the outdoors. He smelled like responsibility. For a moment, being held by him, she remembered what it had been like to be happy. Gotta go, he said at last. Got a lot of driving to do. Go where? She asked, startled. He blinked, then said, Like Vic? Dude, were you listening?
Closely, Vic said, and it was true. She had been listening, just not to him. She had been listening for the phone. She had been waiting for it to ring.
After Lewis and the kid were gone, she walked through the rooms of the brick townhouse on Garfield Street that she had paid for with the money she made drawing Search Engine, back when she still drew, back before the children in Christmasland started calling again, every day. She brought a pair of scissors with her, and she cut the lines leading into each of the phones. Vic collected the phones and brought them to the kitchen. She put them in the oven on the top rack and turned the dial to broil. Hey, it had worked the last time she needed to fight Charlie Manx, hadn't it? As the oven began to warm, she shoved open the windows, switched on the fan. After that, Vic sat in the living room and watched TV in her panties and nothing else. First, she watched headline news, but there were too many ringing phones in the CNN studio, and the sound unnerved her. She switched over to SpongeBob. When the phone in the Krusty Krab rang, she changed the channel again. She found a sports fishing program. That seemed safe enough, no phones in this kind of show. And the setting was Lake Winnipesaukee, where she had spent her childhood summers. She had always liked the way the lake looked just after dawn, a smooth black mirror wrapped in the white silk of early morning fog. At first, she drank whiskey on the rocks. Then she had to drink it straight, because it smelled too bad in the kitchen to go in there and get ice. The whole townhouse stank of burning plastic, despite the fan and the open windows. Vic McQueen was watching one of the fishermen struggle with a trout when a phone began to chirp somewhere near her feet. She looked down at the scatter of toys on the floor, a collection of Wayne's robots, an R2-D2, a Dalek, and of course a couple of Search Engine figures. One of the robots was a Transformers thing, black with a bulky torso and a red lens for a head. It visibly shivered as it chirped once more. She picked it up and began to fold the arms and legs inward. She pushed the head down into the body. She snapped the two halves of its torso together and suddenly was looking at a plastic, non-functional toy cell phone. The plastic, non-functional toy cell phone rang again. She pressed the answer button and held it up to her ear.
"You're a big, fat liar," said Millicent Manx. "And Daddy is going to be mad at you when he gets out. He's going to stick a fork in your eyes and pop them out, just like corks."
Vic carried the toy into the kitchen and opened the oven. Poisonous black smoke gushed out. The cooked phones had charred like marshmallows dropped in a campfire. She threw the transformer in on top of the melted brown slag and slammed the oven shut again. The stink was so bad she had to leave the house. She put on Lou's motorcycle jacket and her boots and got her purse and went out. She grabbed the whiskey bottle and pulled the door shut behind her, just as she heard the smoke detector began to blat. She was down the street and around the corner when she realized she hadn't put anything on besides the jacket and her boots. She was tramping around Greater Denver at 2 a.m. in her faded pink panties. At least she had remembered the whiskey. She meant to go home and pull on a pair of jeans, but she got lost trying to find her way back, something that had never happened before, and wound up walking on a pretty street of 3-story brick buildings. The night was aromatic with the smell of autumn and the steely fragrance of freshly dampened blacktop. How she loved the smell of road, asphalt baking and soft in high July, dirt roads with their dust and pollen perfume in June, country lanes spicy with the odor of crushed leaves in sober October, the sand and salt smell of the highway, so like an estuary in February. At that time of the night, she had the street almost to herself, although at one point 3 men on Harleys rolled by. They slowed as they went past to check her out. They weren't bikers, though. They were yuppies, who were probably creeping home to wifey after a boys' night out at an upscale strip club. She knew from their Italian leather jackets and Gap blue jeans and showroom-quality bikes that they were more used to Pizzeria Uno's than to living brutal on the road. Still, they took their time looking her over. She raised her bottle of whiskey to them and wolf-whistled with her free hand. And they grabbed their throttles and took off, tailpipes between their legs. She wound up at a bookstore, closed, of course. It was a little indie, with a big display of her books in one window. She had given a talk here a year ago. She had been wearing pants then.
She squinted into the darkened store, leaning close to see which one of her books they were peddling. Book 4. The 4th book was out already? It seemed to Vic she was still working on it.
She overbalanced and wound up with her face smushed to the glass and her ass sticking out.
She was glad Book 4 was out. There had been moments when she didn't think she would finish it.
When Vic had started drawing the books, the phone never rang with calls from Christmasland. That was why she had started search engine in the first place.